You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Christ is risen indeed. I am recording this very early in the morning on Easter Wednesday, the 23rd of April 2025. And although we celebrate the resurrection this week, and really every Sunday, there is one part of the world where this is not a joyous occasion, at least not on a day-to-day level. And that certainly is among the Orthodox and pretty much everyone else in what used to be Syria. But, you know, every once in a while, some regime outlet will accidentally say more than they're supposed to, often not fully understanding the impact of what they're saying. And it's bad when the press tries to understand the complex and deliberately fluid situation in Syria. Because of the many actors that are always changing their names, so this is a deliberate policy. The New York Times, for example, says something like this, and this was over 10 years ago. Current and former American officials acknowledge the government's lack of deep knowledge about the rebels in Syria. We need to do everything we can to figure out who the non-ISIS opposition is, said Ryan Crocker, a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq and Syria. Frankly, we don't have a clue. That was published on September 11th, 2014. Now, that fact didn't stop the Jewish New York Times from pretending otherwise ever since then, and the rest of the media as well. I suppose they believe that their reputation will carry their nonsense, but that group who accepts this is getting smaller. And if it weren't for censorship, it would be even smaller still. But the quote says a lot. It's funny how Crocker is very quick to claim that he knows who ISIS is, just not anyone else. And he says the non-ISIS opposition. So we don't really know about anyone else, we know about them. Now, by this point, 2014, the same media were reporting on these boilerplate baby killing and slave market, you know, very lurid stories about ISIS. So in talking about them, they had to make sure that ISIS was somehow distinguished from everyone else. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but those kind of reports have long disappeared. Back then, every week there was a new report about rape camps and against slave marts and harems and everything else that ISIS was running. Now you don't hear anything about that. That doesn't mean that there's been any increase in understanding of that phenomenon, which I was the very first in the universe to expose for what it was, or at least the English-speaking universe. As it resumes its military operations in Gaza, Israel is, as I've said 100 times, very overstretched because it's expanding its ground incursions across South Syria over the last month, maybe, launching airstrikes throughout the country, all over the place. This is sort of a two-front war of a sort, and it's a dangerous game. Now, what I don't understand about a lot of the first-hand accounts, and I'll read a couple of them here, various media, like the Jewish 972, you know, the anti-Zionist 972, whatever the heck they are, which is the name of a journal, and a few others, they act like this is somehow different from normal Zionism. On March 25th, a month ago, Zionists shelled a place called Koya, a small village near the Golan Heights. Nadia Aboud, a journalist from the nearby city in Daria region, and she's actually just reporting what other village residents were saying. And this is what she said. Israeli troops started shooting the farmers as soon as they saw them. These farmers who keep weapons to protect their land, they fired back. The situation quickly spiraled into a larger clash, with the Israeli military launching at least one airstrike on the village. Two of the farmers were killed on the spot. When others rushed to help, the fighting intensified. The people of Daria want peace, and for the earlier agreements to be upheld. If Koya is attacked again, they'll defend it to the last man. What's the shame they couldn't defend their country to the last man? But that attack was one of the deadliest this year. Israel invaded Syria something like 4 months ago, which is really something that, you know, Israel was overstretched on the best of terms. Now, just a few hours after Bashar left for Russia, the IDF moved in and seized all kinds of abandoned Syrian Arab Army checkpoints, occupying chunks of Syrian territory. The Golan Heights is maybe a fifth the size of all of Israel. But since then, the Air Force has been very busy. Early on, it was 600 attacks in the first 8 days. As of maybe a week and a half ago, the IDF has penetrated maybe 12 miles into Syrian territory, building 9 bases and expanding road networks and other communications infrastructure. Now, what the Israeli High Command says is that, well, they're trying to prevent the old Syrian army weapon stockpiles from falling into the hands of the new government in Damascus, so-called, led by Amin al-Sharam, which was at least partially financed by Israel. Now, Stanley, my orange cat, has more legitimacy to run Syria than that guy does. None of these people are Syrian or have any connection to it. Al-Sharam is not anti-Israel. In fact, none of those who took over the country are. And he is on Israel's payroll, so the only thing he's really trying to do was eliminate Iran's influence there. That was Tel Aviv's priority number one. There seems to be an uptick in ISIS reports, although not like they were 10, 12 years ago. ISIS is the Hollywood-style bad guy, as I called it, way back when, with the Charlie's Angels pictures. The so-called terror groups there are financed by Mossad. None are threats. But reports on them require public ignorance and, of course, media control. And that give a plausible excuse to continue their operations. There's not much left there. There were a few villages that actually were prospering under Assad. Well, there aren't many left. There was a demilitarized Syrian-Israeli buffer zone. There was a village close by. December 8th, they awoke to the sound of gunfire. Now, the past 4 months, that village had been under Israeli control. There's only about 400 people there. But around that time, they were all forced out of their homes, their land stolen for, quote, military use. But that's an old line. That was used by Israeli settlers for decades. Now, initially, Netanyahu and, of course, all of the newspapers said that this was only temporary. Building bases and infrastructure suggests otherwise. But anyone who accepts him or Israel's word on anything should be embarrassed. And then Defense Minister Israel Katz did say that Israel is prepared to stay indefinitely. Well, I don't need him to say that. They're clearly doing it. The guy named Mohammed Fayyad. Now, they call him a lawyer, but I don't know what he's a lawyer for. The law that Assad used is gone. It will never be resurrected. So what law does he practice? He can't practice anything. So he's a former lawyer. And this guy was beaten and detained by the IDF a few months ago. He was covering their Israeli operations nearby in the village of Hamidze. In addition to that, this is all 972, that Israeli, you know, anti-Zionist journal. He said that Israeli military officers had been, quote, entering villages in white civilian vehicles to collect data, carrying out statistical questionnaires under the pretext of offering humanitarian aid. They've been offering to pay locals at least $75 a day to build the base's infrastructure. After taking everything from us, they offer us food, medicine, electricity, and work. They aim to provoke division and separation from the new administration. But so far, he noted, residents have been rejecting these offers and refuse any interference regarding the division of Syria. And this is happening in all of these villages, in that area, anywhere near the buffer zone. And they're all doing the same thing that they did in Gaza many years ago and the West Bank today. The U.S. sponsored their national dialogue conference where the various factions all over Syria came together to, quote, discuss the country's future. Done, of course, under American and Israeli auspices. None of these actors are autonomous. And it was only after that so-called conference where all of this stuff began. Omar Hunum, who lives in a very similar, you know, right there on the border, he said, "We've just finished the war. We have no problem starting another one with Israel to defend our country." No, they haven't just finished a war. The war's just gotten started. It's nonsense rhetoric, assuming this guy even exists. It's rhetoric for the cameras. It's almost meant to justify him to an Arab audience. This guy, Hanun, let's say he exists and he's a decent guy. He organized something called the Civilian Protest on February 25th against Israel's military incursion and their behavior. Now, Israel had controlled much of this territory since 1967. But now he decides to protest Israel? Because if this guy wasn't an Assad supporter, then he has no right to protest anything. How is he shocked that Israel's doing what it's done for 50 years? This is the kind of TV-friendly, meaningless demonstration complete with all this mysterious financing. This is what the regime means by civil society. Hanun talks about the invading Israelis. You know, I don't really have to read him. I know exactly what he's going to say because it's the same pattern everywhere. He said they destroyed 100-year-old trees and shot at anyone who came near. They even killed two young men on a motorbike who carried a shotgun with them, which is normal in this region to protect livestock. Again, where has this guy been? There were no gun laws, by the way, under Assad. There will be. Actually, there is, because the Israelis demand all their weapons be handed in. A teacher at the local school there, on the border of Golan, he said dozens of Israeli soldiers are confiscating land. They conduct regular patrols with dogs. He said, "I have lost count of how many times they've entered our village. A neighbor and friend of mine whose land was taken is living in my house. He cries every day because he's lost everything." But this has been Israeli policy since 1948. And by the way, there's no administration in Damascus. There's no government there. I think there's some pictures, but they're militias. They're mercenary armies. They're not governments, and they have no intention of being a government. This is not the first time I'm talking about Israel's invasion and their policies, but it's the exact same thing. The guy, Sheikh Abu Nasser, again from the same region, he starts talking about, these are just civilians, I guess, talking about the invasion, and he says that the local population resisted orders to remain inside their homes and given their weapons. He said that we do not recognize the occupying state. Now, I don't know if he means the Israelis or the militias that overthrew Assad, or maybe they're the same. Well, that might be fine, but if he wasn't a supporter of Assad, he has nothing to say. He then said that the, quote, new government's forces never came to the village to offer assistance. I don't know what they would have done. Again, they're a mercenary army. He said, "We're alone, but we'll stay here in our land even if someone else controls us." Well, okay, you're alone because Assad was overthrown. Not only these mercenary armies and not governments, few of them are actually Syrian. And they are openly and loudly pro-Israel. If you remember, I think it was in February, I talked about the Syrian Druze population. E-R-U-Z-E. It's an occult, Kabbalah-style Gnostic sect. They're about 3% of the country's population. They're in Israel, too. They're a mysterious group. Typical of them, lots of stuff are you know, a secret. But they've more or less been pro-Israel. In Syria, they supported Assad, although that may have been to, I mean, they did pretty well under him, but they also were worried about the Muslims attacking them. The Druze has been pro-Israel, and they're very loyal in Israel proper. Netanyahu and Katz ordered the Israeli army on March 1st to prepare to defend Daramana, which is a Druze village in southern Syria. Katz said, "You will not allow extremist Islamic regime in Syria to harm the Druze." Now, that's a tongue-in-cheek comment. If the regime attacks the Druze in Daramana, we will respond. Now, Daramana today is a refugee center. It used to be a small place. The place is now in chaos. The population grew because it was refugees for displaced people from other areas around Damascus. It was calm for a long time. It was a thriving city before the regime began its war. But I'm telling you, it will never thrive again. There were a few skirmishes, nothing more than that. The Israelis tried to make believe that this was, you know, Islamic militias attacking the Druze. But there are enough people on the ground saying that this was just local armed men, security personnel, I don't know who they're talking about, and representatives of the so-called new government. But no one knows who's who. According to yet another former lawyer, Makram Obaid, he's with something called the Daramana Civil Action Committee, which is absolutely financed by the regime. He did say that these clashes were two unrelated clashes of a personal nature. The incidents led to an agreement allowing the HTS, you know, the group that the Israelis and Turks financed to take over. They only restored order. Somehow they established an office of something, and they shared security responsibilities with somebody. Of course, they served the Israeli state, but this is all very, very vague. Netanyahu has made a big deal about the Druze. Israel, of course, will make up any story it needs to. The truth is, though, that the various, yeah, the two big ones were, you know, the Greek Orthodox used to be 20% of the population, and Muslims. And there's a lot of smaller groups like this that tended to support Assad. It did pretty well. But now they have to negotiate their existence. Israel is still not seen as the obvious cause of this. The regime, that is to say, Israel, the U.S., sometimes NATO, the EU, sometimes Turkey, 15 years of financing these groups. Mossad and the U.S. are more than aware of what they're dealing with. Of course, Israel is using the Druze, and they're going to end up like another Kurd. They're going to make of them a privileged caste that will be paid to carry out Tel Aviv's policy. And they do this because they don't have the numbers. If they take the Golan Heights and even beyond it, Israel's going to go up, I'm willing to say, even parts of South Lebanon, I don't know, 35% larger than what it is now, physically. The army is not going to withdraw from any areas in southern Syria or in the Golan Heights. The local population, you know, as always, the Zionists piss everybody off wherever they go, even the people they try to make friends with. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. But we all know the truth is there's only one force that could have saved them, and that's the Syrian Arab Army. These demonstrations are very suspicious. Every once in a while, you know, they spring up to protest Israeli behavior. All over, you know, Daraa, Foyada, all these places. Now, I want to believe that they're all Ba'ath Party loyalists. Because if they're not, they have no reason to complain. If they're not demanding Assad's return, then I don't want to hear them. And what would a peaceful demonstration accomplish? Was this going to make Israel change their minds? And I firmly believe that these are completely fraudulent because Israel has very advanced facial recognition software. They will arrest these people any participants in this demonstration, so I'm willing to go on a limb and say that these are completely fake. The Druze, there are very few people who know a lot about them. A lot of their doctrine is secret, typical. Some have been told that the Druze have rejected Israeli offers, largely because of their behavior in Syria, not so much in Israel. They do have a militia, believe it or not, the Jaish al-Muwahideen, in their regions, Daramana, etc. But I don't know. I don't take mainstream reports seriously here, but at least there's some information that we can go on. Let me, I guess because all my predictions come true, I'm going to quote myself. And this is from my book, The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, The Failure of Western Engagement in the Islamic World, which was published in 2017. I like that book. It's short and I like it. Here's what I said. I haven't read it in so long. And I'm talking about the Syrian case. Way back, this is 2016 when I wrote it. Joshua Landis, longtime researcher for Syria Comment, points out that the dozens of factions against Damascus are largely business networks. Rebel leader Abu Fadi, who allegedly commands 20,000 men, made his millions in the tourist industry. Jamal Maruf, whose wealth comes from Saudi oil, was recently disavowed by the U.S. for diverting CIA funds for his own personal use. Several of these factions recently fought a brief war over the distribution of plunder from conquered areas, but quickly they regained their equanimity after being threatened with the loss of American sponsorship. Worse, several of these faction leaders have threatened to join Damascus if their interests are not taken more seriously. Now, if that's not sufficient, the U.S. began to promote Ahmad al-Jarba, a drug lord, and they call him the human rights leader there, just like in Kosovo. According to the Lebanon-based journal Al-Akbar, he's wanted in Lebanon, Syria, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar for trafficking in both slaves and narcotics. Now, the Syrian war has permitted Western capitals to reinvent guys like this as fighters for democracy. Raida views him as useful to control the Muslim Brotherhood within the rebel armies. Yarba, who at one point worked for both Saudi and Qatari intelligence, is now mediating the transfer of advanced French weapons to as yet unknown rebel faction. I wrote that. Unknown, of course, means ISIS. Now, the war in Syria has been a very solid example of Johnson's law, because almost nothing about these complex issues released by the mainstream press can be believed, either due to their ignorance or political pressure or both. Remember, the media has zero obligation to educate anybody. They have no obligation to tell the truth. Their job is to tell a story, a gripping narrative, both for their own profit as well as to support the leftist and Judaic agenda. But what's going on in Syria? In simple terms, it's yet another message to the world of how the regime operates. Syria was a thriving, civilized society. It's like the 25th such example. And only journalists and American academics are unable to see the pattern. It's not a civil war, as we all know. The regime, especially the U.S. and the Israelis, started in 2011. Of course, it's not a civil war at all, since Syria was faced with the absolutely brutal and unprovoked NATO and Israeli aggression from all sides. Tens of thousands of Islamic radicals were being bussed in from all over the planet to invade Syria, while at the same time suffocating the country with sanctions, blockades, isolation, and slander. Assad was a good man, a just and humane leader, placed in a very difficult situation, slandered daily from the ignorant. And the worst part of all of this is that those who know only mainstream media reports are uttering their absurd opinions as if they know something. This is why state media is important. Without Sana, which was at least a state-controlled media, his point of view, Assad's point of view, would have been totally lost. Private media would have been immediately bought up by either Turks or Jews or Americans or whomever, and his point of view would have been completely locked out. Over a decade now of that kind of warfare, this is why he had to go, unfortunately. The Ba'ath Party was fairly popular. But by late last year, inflation was so high that one of these regular terrorist fighters, paid by the regime, had a higher salary than a general in the Syrian Arab Army. Of course, it crippled the economy. Total disaster in December last year when Assad had to go. And you have politicians and various regime members who continue to pretend not to know that the defeat of Assad would lead to chaos and the deaths of hundreds of thousands. There is no government in Damascus. It's a mercenary army run by Mossad agents and CIA, as well as BlackRock and many private sector actors, backed by the Israelis, murdering Alawites, Greek Orthodox, Sunni loyalists, and Al-Qaeda and ISIS, of course, are Western-backed. Journalists are ignorant, both because they're in denial, as well as a simple lack of knowledge. And academics are no different because they use journalists, unironically, as evidence. Under both Assads, the oligarchy was broken in Syria. I've gone over this many times. The elder Assad, especially. The economy was growing and doing well, and that was intolerable. Arabs and the Greek Orthodox population had differences, but they did live together very well, with a strong central government that kept order against Islamic radicalism, usually Western-funded. Remember, Assad was re-elected several times in a multi-party race that the West condemned before it occurred. Zelensky won't have an election, but Assad did. Here's what I wrote in 2021. After over a decade of American aggression against Syria, an overwhelmingly popular Bashar al-Assad won the election for president in May of 2021 against two other opponents. Having brought the country through a war meant for its destruction, Assad couldn't lose if he tried. Now, what I meant there, because at the time of that writing, it appeared that Assad had won. The militias were broken. They were in retreat everywhere. The problem was the economic rot that was enforced from the outside, and the constant Mossad presence chipped away at its ability to defend itself. So let me continue quoting myself here again. Actually, I'm not quoting myself. I'm quoting Stephen Lendman, talking about the elections of that year. It's a reality. The U.S.-dominated West and their press, agent media, suppress and their misinformation, disinformation, and fake news about Assad and all things related to the Syrian Arab Republic. Assad is more popular now than when re-elected in June of 2014. There was never any doubt about his triumph, only by how great a majority to be known after ballots were counted. The turnout was almost 80%, a remarkable show of support for the Republic and its leader at a time of war and foreign occupation of the northern and southern parts of the country, including by diaspora Syrian refugees able to cast ballots. Now, who were his opponents? Mahmoud Mireh and Abdallah S. Abdallah. Respectively, they won 3.3% and 1.5%. They tried to make themselves sound as much like Assad as possible, of any of you who followed that election. The second one. At the time, how do you defeat a president who was winning a globally financed war and rebuilding the country with Chinese, Iranian, and Russian help? Of course, there was no united opposition. The radicals who had taken up arms against the state, they're not going to try to compete for an election, especially since they're not Syrian. There's no way to disagree with Assad's basic policy and win, because he was legitimately popular. Other polls show this as well. Now, here's what I wrote. While it sounds like saccharine propaganda, it's true that in Damascus, Latakia, Homs, and other urbanized parts of the country, large numbers of Syrians took to the streets to celebrate Assad's re-election. There were massive rallies all over the country, flooding the streets in every city in support of President Assad, started from the 16th when the campaign started. Back in 2011, before the shooting began, this writer, meaning me, reported that Assad's rallies were at least five times the size of the opposition and were actually covered at first by the regime's media. Shooting started only after the regime's agents were shown to be unpopular and foreign. The total turnout, including parts of the diaspora, was 18,107,109 voters. The number of voters was 14,239,140. That's where the 78.64% rate comes from. Assad received 13,540,860 votes, 95.1%. If the election were rigged, like in the U.S., he wouldn't have chosen such a high number. Like all National Socialist leaders worldwide, he's far too popular to worry about any of this. The UAE, Oman, Bahrain, Jordan, Lebanon, and Kuwait all allowed Syrians and their countries to participate in the election. In the West, however, they were forbidden to vote in an attempt to invalidate the election they knew Assad would win. Of course, the only places at the time that they didn't allow participation was in the Al-Qaeda stronghold of Idlib, which is under NATO control, and the Kurdish SDF part of northeastern Syria. They were invited to take part, but the regime strictly forbade any participation, and people were shot over it. Papers like the New York Times reported zero about Assad's triumph. The Washington Post published an AP propaganda report saying, this is what they actually said, Syrian President Bashar Assad was reelected in a landslide following an election described as illegitimate and a sham by the West and his opposition. Well, that's a fantasy. The regime paints a fantasy picture like this, taken as truth by academics and journalists alike. Well, people like Lenman, some of the few, as well as my listeners, of course, who understand that the AP is not a neutral observer. The AP lied, saying that no independent monitors watched polling stations on election day. They were either lying or just weren't there. The reality is there were monitoring groups all over the place. Russia, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Bolivia, Ecuador, Armenia, and a few other places. And a bunch of others in the Middle East, as I already mentioned. No one from the Western states showed up, so they have no idea if it was fair or not. How many countries oversaw the 2020 election in the U.S.? Or the midterm 2022, both of which were blatantly stolen? Now, if you paid attention, Sana, the main Syrian media outlet, was more than fair to Assad's opponents. State media tend to be. They were given ample time to promote their agenda, which, you know, seemed to be as close to Assad's as humanly possible. Russian election monitors, they reported a few weird irregularities, but very minor ones that had no effect on the outcome. There were no violations of international rules. Assad was untouchable at the time. This election was very important because it matches polls, even foreign polls, about his popularity at the time. The quote-unquote Biden administration at the time falsely claimed that Syria's election was neither free nor fair. The press release, by the way, was written in April, more than a month prior to its actually occurring, with no witnesses in the country. I mean, why shouldn't Assad be that popular? The regime had been waging war on Syria since March of 2011, including, you know, their own proxies like ISIS and the White Helmets, and he was winning. The support for Assad was based on their desire to return to stability and peace. Syria's economy prior to the war was doing very well, which was the very reason why the West had to destroy it. They don't blame him for the conflict since they're not irrational. Their vote and support for Assad is based on the knowledge that the U.S.-NATO war on Syria is to destroy it and to protect Israel, of course. Here's what Assad personally said, and this is 2019. He said the Americans invaded Afghanistan and they got nothing. They invaded Iraq, they got nothing. They started to invade other countries, but in different ways. They changed the various ways they used. The problem with the U.S. is that they fight a survival war from the point of view because they're losing their hegemony. So they wanted to fight the Russian, the Iranian, the Syrian. The Americans always try to loot other countries in different ways. Regarding not just oil or money, financial resources, they loot rights, political rights, every other right. That's been their historical role since at least after the Second World War. It's very difficult to disagree with him. It's kind of a disjointed statement. Maybe it's a translation, but unfortunately, it's certainly not his fault that he couldn't prevent the Israeli-American takeover of the country last year. I can't imagine the stress that that man was under, with his wife had cancer, no less. The regime's mercenaries, of course, are now in charge, so that means the actual civil war has only just begun. There are some that are fighting back, and there are remnants of the very well-trained Syrian Arab army that are floating around. The only people who are safe are those who reach the Russian military bases at Tartus and Kabinim. There are a few thousand there. The Russian military is the only thing that stands between them and death. In contrast to that, the regime is now carving up the corpse of Syria and facilitating the destruction and looting of the once prosperous society. So those supporting these various factions for different reasons, the U.S., Turkey, and Israel, major regime players, they financed and supported various factions, terror cells, most of whom are now integrated into a new, quote, government with no legitimacy. But to be integrated, they have to be integrated by something, and that's largely the Americans. Maybe there's some crumbling to this facade of unity, but looks are always deceiving. Many Americans supported many factions. They always changed their name, changed their leadership. They changed their personal name. But of course, the Kurdish SDF, the Free Syrian Army, the Syrian Free Army. But the Syrian Free Army should not be confused with the Syrian Free Army or the Free Syrian Army or something like that. The Free Syrian Army is much older. That was a NATO-backed militia active since 2011. They're always changing their names and deliberately doing things like that to confuse people. The newer Syrian Free Army, SFA versus the FSA, is composed of American-trained terrorists from the Al-Tanf base, which is an air base, which is where the HTS was trained. That's actually an American base. The American occupation forces have been using that to support various Islamic radical groups since it was founded in 2016. You have people so stupid, and this is the frustrating part, that the FSA was an anti-ISIS group. Can you imagine saying that today? Talk about being sheltered, about using mental gymnastics. There has never been a battle between ISIS and the Americans. Now, I've seen pictures where that's been claimed. I've seen video of nothing, just, you know, tracers going back and forth. I'm told might be that. Same thing goes for Afghanistan, but certainly nothing definitive. You know, I missed something. It's a few years ago, but it continues to go on. The only place that ISIS has ever attacked are those in support of the Palestinian cause. Those are the only enemies of ISIS. That's really the only argument you need. There is no active group fighting Zionism that ISIS hasn't attacked. It was back in 2015, but they keep doing it. Hamas was condemned by ISIS. In fact, any group fighting Zionism they have declared war on, and for very stupid reasons. Now, the alleged reason this time, back in 2015, and it kept changing as time went on, Hamas was interested in, was and is, in a truce with Israel. Because they're interested in some peace agreement, ISIS says that's not militant enough, we're going to make war on them. Well, Hamas had been willing to make a deal with the Israelis for very specific goals and concessions since 1999, including regularizing the relations with the PLO and Fatah back in 2012. But why in 2015? All of that had fallen through. There was actually a video that was released back then. Who knows who it is? It could be anybody. But there was never a reason then to issue any such a warning. There was no open warfare between Israel and Hamas at the time. ISIS has never harmed Israel in the very least, let alone fought it. Oh, and they also claimed that Hamas had been insufficiently strict about enforcing Sharia law. So now they have to be wiped out in Gaza. Here's what their message said, and it's very suspicious. It says, "We will uproot the state of the Jews and you, Hamas and Fatah. And all the secularists are nothing, and you'll be overrun by our creeping multitudes." And you have scholars and journalists who act like this over-the-top rhetoric is not suspicious. If you want to read something, I have when I published this thing on Patreon, it's some comedy. There's a scholarly group, and the article is trying to figure out why Israel has never taken any action against ISIS, but is crazy militant about everybody else, you know, in that movement, allegedly in that movement. I have a quote from them. In order to deconstruct The apparent contradiction between Netanyahu's statement fighting ISIS and Israel's total lack of military engagement against ISIS, one has to recognize that the Islamic State possesses neither the strength nor the military capability to engage in a conflict with a state endowed with a strong political power and professional armed forces such as Israel. These people, this is a mainstream scholarly organization. These are the experts on this. Can you imagine? Just a few years ago, I was told by these same people that ISIS fought Syria's army to a standstill and have largely defeated any American attempt to neutralize it. It was only the Russians that did anything about it. Somehow, they could do all that, have a massive and wealthy global presence, including a fleet of oil tankers that materialized out of nowhere. These are the experts on Middle Eastern politics. Well, they're shielded from reality. They're constrained in their opinions, and therefore they have to engage in this absolute nonsense and sometimes hilarious mental gymnastics. The Pentagon sent a reconnaissance force along with their various militias, SFA, SDF. They occupied a Syrian airbase. Of course, they have no right to do any of this. Al-Damar, about 25 miles northeast of Damascus, used to be a Syrian airbase. ISIS killed several of Assad's infantrymen trying to protect it, but the Americans and the other rebels finished the job. It's well positioned. It's about 15 miles to the east of the highway M5 that leads straight to Damascus, the farthest that the U.S. has ever really penetrated. Now, Turkey has taken the Tias airbase, T4. Also, again, no right to do this. This is a former Syrian airbase. And that would give, that's a central location. Turkey now would have the ability to project power anywhere. Israel and ISIS forces took the base in 2016, although from different ways. The Turks are using the Hisar-type air defense system. Now, they usually use Russian. Hisar is actually Turkish-built. But this is just based on the Russian models. It's actually built by the Turkish defense industry. Again, all of this, the excuse is the struggle against ISIS. That never existed. Again, ISIS has never attacked the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, or Turkey, ever. Not once, not ever. It only attacks their enemies, of course. It's very odd. ISIS doesn't operate aircraft, despite having a fleet of tankers. To be awash in money that no one could ever explain. They have every other kind of military technology you can imagine. No other guerrilla group has. Unfortunately, the Israeli Air Force has actually killed Turkish citizens in their attacks on the base in central Syria. T-4 base has come under Israeli attack. It's hit runways, fuel depots, radars. Three engineers from Turkey were killed. So, Israel has to watch itself. Now, I don't think that Turkey is capable of going to war against Israel without just dropping out of NATO entirely. They would have to kick all the American bases, which would be wonderful, of course, kick all the American bases out of the country, pull back from Azerbaijan, and drop out of NATO completely. Now, it's very possible. Israel can't handle Turkey. They're completely overstretched. They've been defeated in Gaza, at least as of right now, going up against a huge first world military like Turkey is the last mistake that they would make. It makes me laugh when this new, quote, government in Damascus talks about complaining about encroachments on Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. These are foreign-funded, non-Syrian mercenaries saying this. It's a stage play. Now, I do want to mention a couple of things before we go here. David's Corridor. This is a Zionist idea to split Syria in half and dominate the entire region. It's not really an official thing, but the corridor, or a strip of land, is a covert project aimed at linking Kurdish-controlled northern Syria to Israel via a continuous land route. Now, calling it, I guess it's named after King David, which is blasphemy. The Israel project of establishing a strip of land stretching from the occupied Golan Heights through southern Syria all the way to the Euphrates, which would be quite long, all the way to the Iraqi-Syrian border area. That would be the strategic overland channel, right to the heart. Would they be able to dominate the whole country, which is a part of the Greater Israel project? Now, that's mainstream today. Yesterday, even mentioning that would be cause for denunciation. But there's another doctrine, a doctrine where David's corridor is based upon, and that's the peripheral doctrine. A few places they've called it the ocean doctrine, which is a mistranslation. Periphery, ocean. I think they might be similar in Turkic. What's the peripheral doctrine? That's more public than the David corridor. That's what underpins Israeli support for, say, Kurdish autonomy, even since the 60s. The periphery doctrine is something that Americans who understand the Jewish problem should be well aware of. It's a way to mobilize non-Arabs, peripheral powers, going back to the 60s, or even early 70s, pre-revolutionary Iran, even Turkey, forging alliances with ethnic and sectarian minorities in various states, trying to destabilize hostile governments. So with the establishment of the Israeli occupation state in 1948, we know their biggest problem was the lack of human resources. They're not that many of them. Certainly, trained men are a problem. Even Ben-Gurion himself was an early theorist of this. The strategy was something that Jews are used to all over the world. In order to dominate the area, other than just relying on the Western powers, that's one thing. But they have to make friends with minorities in hostile states, Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, as a way to destabilize them if necessary. Now, this should be very familiar to many of my listeners. The problem was Tel Aviv is worried about a unified Arab front. The periphery doctrine really, I want to say even in the 50s, it began. Initially with Turkey, Ethiopia, and pre-revolutionary Iran, the Kurds, Maronites in Lebanon, always using them to act as a fifth column in countries otherwise hostile to them. The book, The Periphery Doctrine in Israeli Foreign Policy, Gene Seaman and Baruch Uziel, who wrote The Periphery Alliance, A Proposed Policy for Israel in 1959. Because Israel was pretty much encircled, they needed to use minorities, non-Arab minorities, to try to destabilize Arab states. Now, of course, they can't use the Iranians anymore, but they are using minorities within it. They use the Druze, the Copts, Kurds, Berbers, various Christian groups, especially in Lebanon, and even the South Sudanese. It's no different than how they function in the United States. They build links with minorities, trying to claim that they're sympathetic. Those suffering at the hands of Arabs or whites, they tell their clients this. And it's a long-term policy. Victory is always temporary. This is a Jewish survival strategy in a very important way. It shouldn't surprise anyone that this would arise in Israeli foreign policy. Supporting these groups would have a reserve army dependent on the Jews that could be used to war against governments that might threaten Israel. They do this in every country where they go. There's nothing new here. And that explains why all of a sudden in 1990, the Kurds, that no one ever cared about before, were romanticized beyond belief and still are. There's a former Mossad officer, Yossi Alfer, wrote the book, The Periphery, Israel's Search for Allies in the Middle East, said that Mossad is always passing intelligence reports to these groups. And he's talking about the pre-revolutionary Iranians, that is under the Shah, concerning Egypt's activities in Arab countries, among other things, supporting the Turkish rebellion in northern Iraq against Baghdad. Mossad and the police in the Shah, and actually in Persia, cooperated against the Yemenis. Tel Aviv received oil from Iran via the Eilat Ashkelon pipeline, passing through the Suez Canal. There's another book, Israel's Secret Diplomacy in Lebanon, secret relations were built with the Maronite Flange Party in Lebanon, creating this common threat, the Sunni Arab majority, that threatened their identity. And yet even mentioning this, by the way, in the EU could lead to a prison sentence, because this is how the Jews operate. Now you have book after book saying this is exactly right. I mentioned the Druze a couple of months ago. Creating the Druze state near the Golan Heights has been part of the agenda for a while. It's part of this very same periphery. They have a geographic area inhabited by them in near the Golan Heights and Jabal al-Druze in Syria, extending into Lebanon. They want to create a separatist state. And the Druze in Israel are in the army. They're integrated into Jewish society. Like one day after the fall of Assad, Netanyahu sent a message to the Druze of Syria. I was the only one who noticed this. As significant anyway. He said, I send first and foremost a hand of peace to our Druze brothers in Syria. To our brothers. To our Israeli Druze brothers. I think that's a bad translation, but that's what it says. Here's what I said about this in February. The Gnostic Druze were supporters of Assad, but only to protect themselves against Islamic fundamentalists. With Assad gone, they're vulnerable to attack. Today, the number may be 700,000 in Syria, around the Golan Heights, and 140,000 in Israel proper. Being Gnostics, they're close to the esoteric Kabbalah, and historically have cooperated with Jewish mercantile interests. They've never really been anti-Zionist. They've been more or less allies of Tel Aviv. Many Druze today are seeking Israeli citizenship that live outside of the country. Now, the Kurds are another matter. Starting in the 1960s, part of the same periphery doctrine, creating trouble in this case, Iraq. The Shah's Iran and the Kurds converged against Iraq, the Iraqi state. Mossad was sending teams to northern Iraq to train Kurdish fighters in combat. They're still doing that today. By 1965, Israel had a permanent presence in the Kurdish mountains of northern Iraq. So in 1990, when suddenly the Kurds became these martyrs, they had been armed by Mossad for a long time. I'm pretty sure the New York Times didn't mention that at the time. Relationship with Turkey concerning this is, of course, this is another matter. 10 Turkish citizens were killed by an Israeli military strike trying to break the naval blockade of Gaza a few years ago. Now, Turkey, that of course, that's bad enough. But it was a Gaza slaughter that pushed Turkey even farther away. This is why the periphery doctrine now has kind of reemerged. Azerbaijan's another one. Israel was one of the first to recognize Azerbaijan in 92 when it seceded from the Soviet Union. Developed its armed forces. Same thing with Georgia, by the way. Drones, missile systems. This is what helped, you know, along with Turkey, them take Nagorno-Karabakh a few years ago. Israel worked through the AIPAC to mediate between Baku and Washington against the Armenian lobby. In return, Tel Aviv gained an ally adjacent to Iranian territory and obtained 40% of Israel's oil consumption from Baku. I think that's a little high. But this is what the periphery doctrine is. It's central to Israeli foreign policy. In fact, it's central to Judaism as a political matter. I'm not sure how anyone could possibly not realize what would happen when Assad would leave. Or that there's a government in Damascus, that these mercenary armies suddenly have created bureaucracies and an IRS and a Census Bureau. It's just lazy thinking. It's lazy writing. The militia that took over, the HTS, has already signed agreements with the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, integrating Kurds into the, frankly, non-existent Syrian state. Same thing for the Druze. That sounds like it's a contradiction to Israeli policy, but the militias in Damascus were financed, at least in part, by Mossad. Now, David's Corridor, of course, is a part of this. Using all of these groups, it's less a logistical imperative than a political ambition. And they need a lot of non-Jewish fighters and sympathizers in order to make any of this work. If Israel's going to continue to grow larger, they don't have the population to man it. There's only so many settlers. Don't be surprised if they start bringing, you know, the Protestant evangelicals over, teaching them how to shoot and bringing them in, paying them a huge amount of money. The Al-Tanf base on the Syrian-Iraqi border, they wanted to stop the so-called Iranian land bridge from Tehran to Beirut. This is what David's corridor, really an answer to that. It is explicit American policy. Whenever anyone talks about federal Syria, like the Israeli foreign minister, Gideon Saar, a federal Syria means a broken up, fragmented society, poor and weak. Israel Constant Defense Minister said that Israeli troops will remain in Syria, Mount Hermon and Golan, and it will do it until Syria is torn apart, with each militia having their own chunk of land, all under the control of the regime. There have been demonstrations against this, as if that's going to matter. They took Assad for granted. There was a writer, I think it was from the New York Times, said the new Syrian leadership appears remarkably, quote-unquote, disinterested in confronting Israel, at least over the corridor. That's because Mossad has financed them in order to destroy Syria. The Turks are opposed to the partition of Syria, and they're starting to realize that their role in Assad's ouster was a mistake. David's corridor is nothing else but Israeli expansionism taking most of that country, using Kurdish manpower, Druze manpower, and as yet another attempt to cut Iran off from Lebanon, and an oil pipeline from Kirkuk to Erbil, using the Kurds, even bypassing Turkish routes. You're going to hear a lot more about the Kurds in coming years, how wonderful they are, about the Druze. I bet you there's going to be a whole series of books and papers romanticizing them, because suddenly they're necessary for greater Israel. And the Euphrates has always been their symbolic frontier. It is possible to drag the Americans in because Donald Trump in particular, but any president in general from the U.S. will, as the Arrow Air case, if you look back, the Arrow Air flight where 250 American soldiers were killed in Canada because the Israelis didn't like them, that was completely covered up. They'll have American soldiers die before they do anything against the Israelis. They'll use ISIS for a lot of this. But you're not going to hear too many more stories about them murdering babies for no reason. But Israel is dealing with a shrinking population, and the U.S. is no longer a superpower. The IDF has been battered in Gaza. That the future is absolutely uncertain. But reading mainstream sources, even some anti-Zionist sources, be extremely careful. If it doesn't make any sense, it's not true. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Christ is risen. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.